All right. Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Creditor Podcast. I'm your host, Chase Palmieri, and with me today is Vanessa Otero. She's the CEO and founder of Ad Fontes Media, and the company's mission is to make news consumers smarter and news media better. And one of the ways that they do that is with their very famous, often cited media bias chart. Vanessa, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I know that you didn't originally start in this space. You started out as a patent attorney. I'm very curious how you ended up kind of getting into this in that very first time that you constructed the media bias chart.
Yeah, it was sort of by accident. It was in the run-up to the 2016 election. And you know, as a patent attorney, my job, you know, I've been a licensed patent attorney for 7 years. I left my practice last year to focus on Ad Fontes Media. But you know, in 2016, just being a patent lawyer, and part of my job is to explain complicated things in words and pictures. And you know, pictures tend to be the thing that drive understanding for a lot of people. So I would just notice that people would fight online about their news sources. And you know, they'd argue with each other about politics, and one person would throw like a HuffPost link, and another person would throw a Breitbart link, and neither of those things convinced the person that they were talking to, just because of, you know, bias, credibility issues, and whatnot. And I figured, you know, it would be helpful to like lay out in a visual format better, worse news sources, more left, more right news sources in a chart. And so I just used like the Microsoft Visio diagramming the program that I have for making patent drawings to make, you know, a fairly ugly first media bias chart, because I have no graphic design skills whatsoever. And it took me totally by surprise that it got so popular online and went viral, and people would ask me for more data, more sources, and my methodology and all that.
Yeah, and can you explain the chart? Because maybe just kind of the X and Y axis?
Yeah, so it's a two axes. If you haven't seen it before, it's you know, the vertical one is for reliability. So it's news value and reliability are what we're measuring. But generally, people think of like top is good, middle is okay, and bottom is bad, right? And then from left to right on the x-axis, that's the you know, political bias. So political bias is not just, you know, political position, but it's also like the language that people use to compare, to talk about their political issues and opponents, and make characterizations and things like that.
Okay. And I'm going to make sure that everybody can see this chart. You're most up to date. I think it's version 7.0. Is that right?
Yep. That's right. Yeah, we've changed it quite a bit over the last few years, where initially it was just, you know, the first version was just me, but now I've got a team of 40 analysts. We can get into how we do our ratings now. But yeah, it's got news sources plotted all across that whole two-dimensional map.
Okay, so let's just let's imagine that two-dimensional map. I'm going to throw it up for listeners, but can you give us maybe an example of somebody at the top and at the bottom and somebody at the very extreme right and extreme left?
Yeah, so we've got at the very top are our like Wire Services and some like very well known longstanding news publications. Wire Services at the top, and in the middle being like AP and Reuters. Some other good news sources up there are like, you know, NPR. You know, the it skews a little bit left, like ABC, NBC, CBS, major networks, and then we've got on the, you know, bottom left corners. It sort of resembles like a inverted V, because there's quite a bit of correlation between reliability and bias, but it's not a perfect correlation. So you'll see like sort of towards the middle, of the reliability scale, that's even if it's though it's not super far right or left, like the Daily Mail, which is a British tabloid of, you know, questionable reliability. Like some stuff is fine, but then occasionally, not infrequently, they'll just, you know, drop these stories that are you're pretty far-fetched.
Yeah.
Even though they're not politically biased. And left and right, you've got like your InfoWars or Natural News in the bottom right. You've got sources like Palmer Report on Occupy Democrats on the bottom left.
Okay. And you mentioned already that the very first version was just kind of you taking your own kind of thoughts and feelings and laying those out. But what is the methodology now? Who is, what's the process of coming up with these updated charts every year?
Yeah. So, you know, we, at the very beginning, when people would ask for my data and methodology, you had a methodology in my head about how I went about evaluating these news sources. Like, I would look at each individual article, and you know, I came up with like, what are the things that make it, you know, more true, more false, like more fact analysis or opinion. What makes it false or misleading? Like, what makes a news source actually good? And I, you know, created a bunch of metrics for that. And then what makes a news source more left or more right? Because we can kind of identify what's left and right just sort of intuitively, but what makes it more biased or like very extreme or just like a little bit biased? So I set out some metrics for that. And over the years, at first we recruited some volunteer analysts to help do this. And to mitigate my own bias, I figured that I had to have folks that were had different viewpoints across the political spectrum. So, you know, folks that self-identified left, right, and center. So our teams are balanced teams like that. Now we have paid analysts, and we've got 40 of them. They're the best people in the whole world. We've got you know, recent college grads. We have PhD students. We have retirees with careers who had careers in a lot of different sectors. We have teachers and journalists. So we really have a range of analysts of left, right, and center political viewpoints, and you know, they're all trained in this methodology that I've developed and refined over the last over 5 years now. So we train them on expression and veracity and what the headline and graphic means. And we train them on political position bias and language bias and comparison bias and all these, you know, sub factors that we use. So how we do it in how we rate a whole news source right now is by rating individual articles or episodes. We do websites, but we also do podcasts and TV shows. So if it's a podcast or TV show, obviously we'll do an episode, but we try to get a sample, representative sample of at least, you know, 15 articles for each one, each web source. Some of them we have several dozen, some of them we have well over 100 articles as our sample. And each one's rated by three analysts, one left, one right, one center, in a shift on Zoom where they talk about it, you know, they discuss any discrepancies and come to agreement. And they really come to remarkable levels of agreement doing it that way. So we found the system works really well.
Very cool. And it sounds like your process would have to have some kind of limitation. Maybe it's a certain number of outlets. Maybe you pick the most popular or prolific outlets today and you focus on those.
Yeah. So we've grown it over the years since it's a, you know, manual process, and we're working on automating pieces of it. You know, everyone would love for this to be just done automatically, just AI instantly. There's reliability and bias rating on it, but you know, the technology's not there yet. And in order to get it there, you just need some real domain expertise and a lot of data. And we're creating that right now. So we started with, you know, 80 to 100 sources, just sort of the most popular ones. We'd go by, you know, Alexa rankings for volume. We'd go by requests, things that were, you know, popular in the news. So we've got nearly 500 web sources, like web and print sources. We've got about 150 podcasts and 150 TV shows, like news TV shows.
Wow.
Under our belt now.
And I'd imagine that over the years, calling out these publishers has not always been easy or hasn't always received a great response. Are there some stories or context you can give us on how certain publishers have maybe responded negatively or requested to be reevaluated?
Yeah, so not everyone loves us, as you can imagine. So, but it's different, the kind of responses that you get from the publishers across the spectrum. You know, the thing about publishers that are like in the bottom corners is that, you know, they don't like what we're doing, but they also sort of know what they're doing, you know, like they're sort of doing this on purpose. They're being super biased and maybe not telling the truth all the time. So my favorite and most flattering story is from InfoWars. Like a few days after I put out the first media bias chart, you know, they put up an article and their own chart on their website saying that, like, obviously I'm a, you know, mainstream media corporate shill or something. And, you know, they are really the source of truth. And their chart had like a couple of axes, like freedom and tyranny. And the other axis was like, I don't know, corporate or non-corporate. I don't know what it was, but they were at the apex of that chart. And then, you know, the NBCs of the world were at the opposite end. You know, so that was, you know, obviously they were just trying to attack what we were doing. But I find it more gratifying to get responses from some of the higher ranked news sources, because even if they're ranked highly, obviously they're trying to do some good journalism, and we've like recognized that already. And often they don't really want to be perceived as biased. So sometimes a news source with like a fairly good score will be like, how can we lean a little bit left, you know? And how can you, we're trying not to. So, you know, we'll do audits for publishers internally, so they can sort of measure their own bias, because as you can imagine, and they'll get complaints. It's people saying like, oh, you're so left, or oh, you're so right. And they just sort of want a sanity check. And often they are like pretty close to the middle, but you know, human bias comes into play and just, it happens.
Yeah. And so do those publishers that you do the audit for, do they pay for that? Or are you just kind of in your own process of coming up with these ratings, you're taking notes on how they could do better, and then you just share those with them?
Yeah. So we just recently started offering publisher audits and licensing. So as you can imagine, you know, one of the main questions that we get, you know, is like, how do you make money and how are you funded? And does that affect your credibility and your independence and all that, right? So I just want to start by saying that like, we are a for-profit public benefit corporation. So we're not a nonprofit. A public benefit corporation is like the legal certification that you need in order to maybe become a B Corp one day. It just means you have a stated public mission in addition to being for profit. And we made a decision about that really early on, that we wanted to do that because there's a really big problem that we're trying to address. And there's never ending unlimited content to rate. So we could be a nonprofit and, you know, get some grants or something, but then we, like, no matter how much money that is, even if it's a few million bucks, like, you can run out of it trying to rate all the news that's out there. So we knew that there was a need and that we needed to grow to meet the need to rate all the content in the news landscape, which is why, you know, we wanted to make this a business. So that said, who are our customers? Our customers are really all the stakeholders in good news media. There's consumers, of course, who want to, you know, make sure they're not spreading misinformation and learn themselves. Educators who need to teach media literacy. There's a brands that support news content, whether it be good or bad. There's the publishers and there's social media companies, right? So all these folks like are our stakeholders. So yes, we do charge for publisher audits and publisher like licensing meaning if we say, you know, this source got a good score and they say, oh, can we use that in a press release or like in our advertising or things like that? Yes, they can pay us a licensing fee for our trademark to use it like that. What keeps us from, you know, puffing up the score of somebody who paid for a certification? Well, if we do that, we lose credibility with all of our other stakeholders, right? Like, if brands can't trust us or social media companies can't trust us because a publisher pays us, then why would they pay us too, you know? So having the diffuse stakeholders is a mechanism that keeps us honest.
Okay. And you mentioned that you licensed the chart for kind of press articles and that kind of thing. Have you ever thought about licensing the ratings for kind of the back end ranking or sorting of mm-hmm. content platforms? Like, let's mm-hmm. take Facebook. It's in the news mm-hmm. all the time for the issues of content credibility on their platform. Mm-hmm. Would you ever consider working directly with them so that they could use your ratings to better surface credible content?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do hope that you know, third-party ratings do become a standard that social media platforms rely on. And you know, there are others, obviously there's Creditor and there's other competitors in the industry. This is a new industry of news content ratings. right? People think of ratings as like, you know, the, like Nielsen ratings for publicity, but we refer to it as ratings. That's like, we sort of stay away from rankings because that implies it's an order, but your rating for, and there's a bunch of different approaches in how to do that for reliability or bias or both, right? So there are a few companies like ours in the space. And I think the fact that there are multiple companies is helpful because you can check against a couple just to make sure, like, is this just, you know, like one person or one company saying it's that way? If you have multiple companies with multiple approaches and methodologies, sort of arriving at similar conclusions, then I think consumers tend to have more faith in those conclusions. And then the social media platforms themselves can in turn rely upon these third party ratings. So absolutely. I think ultimately, like, this is something that the platforms have to take on and have to address. Like, consumers like demand it and need it just to have at least some labeling or some information about the content that they're just being funneled and presented, right? So even if it's not, you know, limited in some way, if at least there's more information presented to the end user, they can make better decisions. Like, we have content ratings on movies, like about violence and, you know, nudity and that kind of stuff. It's like G, PG, PG-13. So it doesn't tell you like you can't go see this, or but it lets you know what you're about to walk into. Like, you should know if you're walking into something that's like not very credible and like super left or super right.
Yeah, I agree. I think third-party ratings, the more the better for consumers. And mm-hmm. not only is there those kinds of ratings, you know, G, PG-13, rated R, but there's mm-hmm. also already various media rating or mm-hmm. rating sites for movies in general with IMDb right. and Rotten Tomatoes. And so if I'm Absolutely. About to spend the next 2 hours of my life watching a movie, maybe I lean towards Rotten Tomatoes, but I can also check IMDb. And if they're similar enough, I have even more confidence in that score. So I agree. Absolutely. I think the more third-party ratings, the better. So mm-hmm. maybe let's take a step back and what is the ideal outcome or goal of the media bias chart? Obviously, your stated mission is to make news consumers smarter and news media better, but maybe you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, I mean, look, we want to fix the news, the media ecosystem. You know, clearly it's broken, right? And I think we're sort of in this temporary phase, like these growing pains of this new information age. You know, and this has happened in history before, and I'm an optimist that like more information ultimately results in like, you know, just a better world for all of us, like more access to information. Think about when the printing press came out, right? Or like when radio or TV came out for the first time, there were like, you know, learning curves and hiccups, like not everybody knew how to read, you know, when the printing press came out and people had to learn to become literate. You know, radio came out, there was a whole Orson Welles thing and people freaked out and they're like, oh no, what does this mean for mass communication and society? It turns out radio is fine and it helps us all. The same thing with TV and same thing with internet. But like, we've really seen the rapid acceleration in the 2010s to now, that whole decade has come and gone, where we've got like smartphones and social media platforms and internet news sites. Just like the proliferation due to those technologies has just resulted in, sorry.
No worries.
Sorry. And now my dogs are barking because there's somebody outside. This is just sort of the nature of, you know, working from home all the time. Apologies for that.
No worries.
So having having these growing pains of this like new information age, I think that's where we are now. So we've got to learn how to deal with it, right? And all people, like this, all those stakeholders that I mentioned in Good News Media, have to do their part to deal with it. So what's our problem now? Well, people live in like these different filter bubbles, information silos. People believe different things. We don't have the same like common basis of fact, and that hinders us from accomplishing policy goals in government. It hinders us from like making good decisions about something like the coronavirus. Lets a large section of the population become misled if somebody's promoting certain falsehoods, right? That can lead to the destabilization of our own democracy, as we saw in January 6th. And similar things have happened around the world. So, you know, how do we fix those things? Well, it can't just be like, well, consumers need to figure it out and get better, or it can't be, you know, social media companies need to do, they need to police all the information, or the government needs to change the law so that misinformation is not allowed. It's not just one entity that can fix it by themselves. Everyone sort of got to come together and do their piece. And so I just see news ratings as a really fundamental part of helping all those, you know, stakeholders figure out what they can do to make the news ecosystem better from their standpoint.
I think that's absolutely right. It's not just one solution. And I think the reason it's not just one solution is that this distrust in news that we're experiencing at mass record scales is not really a result of just one problem. We call out, obviously, the kind of advertising-based model that supports journalism today, obviously pretty problematic and leads to a lot of the clickbait and sensationalism. But there's also elements of the fact that anybody can quickly publish content online now, which is great, but it comes with problems. And there's a lot of different things going on here that are kind of leading to this. I know that you guys are doing some work on the kind of programmatic advertising side of things. I think your product's called Ad Apex Brand Safety. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So the whole idea is that, you know, brands are, as you said, the funders of news. You know, they it's ad supported journalism has been, it's a big part of news for a really long time. And there's good and bad things about that, right? And the way that ad support journalism recently has hurt a lot of good journalism outlets, but allowed bad ones like junk, what we call junk news, to thrive. And by junk news, I mean just the whole bucket of misinformation, disinformation, fake news, and hyperpolarizing or extremist content. So I kind of mean all of those things when I say junk news. And what I mean by like the advertisers support that is that how they run ads online is programmatically. And a lot of news consumers don't really realize this. I mean, you can kind of get the sense that, like, you know, that when you click on something, you should like shop at a site, you click on an ad, or you even buy something offline, ads for those things and similar things follow you on the internet. And it doesn't really matter where that ad gets run. It gets run programmatically, automatically through these ad tech platforms to just basically follow you around the internet, right? So that means that if you are frequenting sites that are like fake news, junk news, like totally misleading, you know, giving you bad information, you know, that brands that you love and buy stuff from are funding that site because a portion of their ad dollars is going to that site. Now, brands don't necessarily want that or mean for that to happen. It's just kind of like this side product, right? On the flip side of that, you've got these brand safety concerns. So brand safety is kind of a bucket term for advertisers that encompasses the idea that they don't want to be seen sponsoring content that's unfavorable to them in some light. And that can mean everything from like making sure an airline ad doesn't run next to an airplane crash story, or and it can also mean things like they don't appear on a porn website or like something that has got violent or racial slurs, that kind of content on there. That's all brand safety. So sometimes in order to, like, the technology that exists to make sure brands don't run by that content is sort of blunt force. Like they'll use keywords to block things. So they'll say like, I don't want to run next to anything controversial. So if it has the word Trump in it, I'm just not going to run an ad on it. Well, if Trump's the president, then all the news, like all those news content places, like the ads don't run there. And that demonetizes legitimate, reputable journalism. So our product is meant to just take our news ratings and make them digestible and usable so that an advertiser can say, this news content is good, I want to support it. This news content is misleading, I don't want my ads to run in it, or this is too left or too right or whatever. It does not align with my values, and they can make a better decision that way.
Yeah, I want to stick on this one for a bit because I think there's a lot of nuance in this kind of programmatic advertising and your licensing model for brand safety. we've seen that advertisers are getting more and more tepid about advertising on news content in general, because it's somewhat controversial and divisive, and they don't want that for their brand. You know, they want everybody buying Nikes, not just Republicans or Democrats, for example. And so in some ways your product could actually help give them the confidence to come back and spend more money to support the journalism sites that are creating that content. I think there's also, a potential backfire here, which is that maybe it ends up supporting websites that don't cover sensitive or important topics, but maybe report on news stories like what Kim Kardashian's up to, for example, because that's a safer place to place your ad, as opposed to somebody who's maybe critiquing the prison industrial complex or the military industrial complex or something like that. Do you have any thoughts on that kind of nuance?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to distinguish between at least two dimensions of reliability and, you know, that reliability and news value. So news value encompasses things like importance, you know. So if you really wanted to just stick with, like, you know, so you talk about a brand that's just maybe they backed away from news completely because they want to avoid stuff that's controversial, which is, again, damaging to the journalists of the world. It's really damaging to local news, especially, right? So you want them to come back. You can kind of, you can show them, look, this stuff meets the highest levels of criteria for news. The IAB, they came out with a report called the News Trust Halo that shows that, like, consumers actually, you know, trust brands that advertise in news, and, like, you know, there's a positive reinforcement halo around those brands for supporting news content. So they actually should come back to it. But again, they want to avoid things that are, you know, what they view as controversial, right? It's not as simple as, like, controversial or not, right? It's like a prison industrial complex or reporting on private prisons. That doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, extremist or like a very biased, you know. You can report on that in a way that's really highly factual and well argued, and that's something that we should, that should fall within, like, the highest parameters. So, you know, making, as long as you're making sure that stuff isn't outside, like, a certain bias threshold or isn't below a certain reliability threshold, that helps you capture those dimensions of nuance. It won't automatically exclude reporting on, like, LGBT issues, civil rights issues, right? That's, those are not inherently divisive. Like, there's news stories, you know, about Supreme Court cases all the time. You wouldn't want to just block those just because they have the words LGBTQ in there, right?
Right. And there's a few other companies in our space, obviously Kreder is one of them, NewsGuard, The Trust Project, Our.News, even some new competitors like Logically popping up. I'm curious, just NewsGuard seems to be one of the biggest names in our space. How is AdFontes Media different than NewsGuard?
Well, you know, we measure the bias scale too. So there's a couple differences to our approach. So, you know, I think highly of NewsGuard and their approach. You know, it's just a different one. I think highly of all the companies in our space that are trying to tackle this problem. So, you know, what they do is they rate along nine, then is, I think it's fluctuated between 9 and 11 journalism criteria. So they have journalists vet the publications themselves as a whole for reliability, and they give it a reliability score that's you know, green, yellow, red, or just green and red. There's a couple different designations in there, and there's like a 0 to 100 score. So our approach is different in a couple ways. One is reliability and bias. Two, it's, our categories, we have like 8 different categories for reliability and 7 different categories for bias, because we really feel like the gradient is important. The other thing is that we do an article by article basis and a source level basis, because, you know, trying to say, like, New York Times is this, or CNN is this, or Wall Street Journal is this, or Fox News is this, it's really hard at a source level, especially when it's really large. People say, like, well, what about the opinion pieces? Or what about, like, do you differentiate between news and opinion? And yeah, like, each one of those articles are different. So when we rate a left-leaning opinion article from the New York Times or from the Wall Street Journal, it'll say left-leaning opinion article. But if we rate the fact reporting neutral, like minimally biased article, it'll be right in the middle of our chart and much higher. So differentiating between those gives you more intelligence about like an overall rating for the source. And when it comes to something like Fox, like these TV shows, there's a really big difference between from show to show. Morning news shows on CNN and Fox are typically very straightforward and a lot of actual news reporting. Like these 13 things happened and we'll tell you about them in an hour. You go down to your prime time shows, they get very opinionated, very biased. On Fox especially, they become the subject of these like brand safety boycotts because their hosts like fly off the rails and say really inappropriate things a lot of the time. It's important to differentiate, you know, down to that article or the episode level. And so we're just really focused on doing that content and like the content analysis piece. That's really at the heart of what we do. The name Ad Fontes means to the source, because we are looking at the source itself for what it tells us about the reliability and the bias of the content.
I think it's absolutely right. I think you have to do your ratings based on the article level or individual piece of content level. Otherwise, it's just going to be too broad and too vague of a rating. And I think what you're doing, and same with Kreder, is by doing your ratings on the article level, you are positioning yourself in a way where if there ever is to be an AI for content mm-hmm. credibility in the future, it's not going to be like asking, hey, was this outlet green, yellow, or red? They're going to want to mm-hmm. see, okay, this piece of content, this text, mm-hmm. or this audio received mm-hmm. this rating, and that's what's going to help it train up. So mm-hmm. I agree. I totally agree with your approach. Mm-hmm.
I want to say one more thing about that. This is the article by article thing. This is what trips people up about modern misinformation. This is what gets people really lost about a source like RT, Russia Today, and why it's a very effective misleading source for a lot of folks. It's misleading because it's only misleading sometimes. And, you know, if you look at the spread of articles, like it mixes in a lot of like fact reporting. They've hired credible journalists from the United States for RT, for the stuff they have on the RT USA channels. But they have like TV and web content, and those pieces of content differ, but they can like sneak in because they gain this credibility with the audience from news stories that are straightforward and factual. They can slip in things that are misinformation and people don't detect that they're misinformation. You know, they can sneak in, you know, what RT does a lot in particular is that their opinion pieces won't be necessarily like identifiably right or identifiably left. They're just more identifiably anti-American, like the government sucks and this is why, and like, you know, the US government sucks, and you know, they'll throw in something that's like a little bit of red meat for right leaning people and a little bit of red meat for left leaning people, and kind of like gathering the angst of folks from both sides. And so it's opinionated, but not identifiably like right wing or left wing. And I think that's really insidious. So we have to be able to detect that on the article by article basis.
Yeah, because you don't want to throw out a great piece of journalism and punish the author mm-hmm. Or that piece of content and just label it as not true. But that's why you need to be nuanced and do it at the article level. Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah. So NewsGuard and then yourselves seem to be focused on the revenue model of this kind of helping out with the programmatic advertising things. Mm-hmm. Founder to founder, is that because it's just the biggest market opportunity? Is it because maybe it's the easiest first application of these news mm-hmm. ratings? Why is that?
Yeah, well, look, like I said, this is a big problem to solve, right? In order to try to, you know, rate all the content out there, we do have to grow, and there is a lot of money in the media business, right? In advertising, in publishing, in social media, right? So each of these industries, you know, spends a lot of money producing content, advertising on content, distributing content. It's like what makes up the internet and what makes up all this stuff that we read and watch in society. A lot of aspects of that system have profited from breaking stuff, you know, from like making things not ideal. Like, oh, there's been a lot of profit made on the backs of misinformation and divisive content. The folks who come in to help clean it up should get paid for doing so, right? And right. So, yeah, like founder to founder, there is more revenue opportunity there. There is certainly revenue opportunity with, you know, consumers and educators because people need this information, right? However, you know, we live in this like subscription economy where like everything is a subscription. Everyone wants you to buy some stuff, and you know, newspapers themselves, which are some of the greatest producers of content, like the New York Times, you struggle to, you know, they do a pretty good job, but like, you know, not everybody wants to pay $10 or $4 or $17 for even the New York Times, which is like amazing journalism, or the Wall Street Journal, like all these sources with paywalls. So, you know, just to ask people to, you know, pay and support, that's a tougher road to slog business-wise. And at the same time, you know, folks need this information. So, you know, that's why we sort of address all these things, but we are focused on, you know, brands, publishers, and social media companies because they're big drivers of the problem and they're in positions to pay for solutions.
Yeah. And Creditor is for profit as well. And so we intend to make money with our solution. And we also intend to try as hard as we can to not have to make money via advertising or by mm-hmm. charging the news consumers themselves. Mm-hmm. I guess just to stay on that for another second, mm-hmm. is it that the programmatic advertising brand safety market is a bigger market opportunity than, say, going directly to these social media sites and search engines?
Not necessarily. Because there's both, there's opportunity in both. It just sort of looks different. Look, with social media companies pay a lot of money, like internally and to outside vendors, to try to solve their content moderation problems. So just think about content moderation in terms of like hate speech and porn and violence. They have lots of human agents with external companies that are reviewing content at, you know, great detriment to the human workers who have to like view this stuff. You know, there's stories about like PTSD that these employees face because, you know, it can't all be done by AI. Now, moderating misinformation and bias is harder technologically because it's easier to say like this post has a racial slur in it than like these set of words together are not true in view of all the other information that we have in the ecosystem, right? It's just harder to detect automatically. So you do need humans for that. So there is like a big content moderation opportunity. And, you know, the social media platforms are, you know, multi-billion dollar platforms. So yeah, there's like probably just as much or more money there in, you know, trying to fix this problem for social media companies. But there's also a similar opportunity for, you know, for brands in ad tech. You know, they're just different types of markets. And, you know, how to integrate solutions like ours, like our news rating solutions, is just different in each one of those cases.
Yeah. And have you all thought about expanding the media bias chart to, say, maybe do one for the 60 most prolific journalists themselves, not even the brands, but maybe just individuals or other ways that you can kind of extend the same methodology to create different charts?
Yeah, well, we've sort of avoided journalists on purpose just because, a couple of reasons. One is like a little personal, I find, and we can kind of get at what we're looking for by grading the homework rather than the student, you know, grading their paper, essentially. And it when you say like, especially when it comes to bias, when you say this person is right or this person is left, well, not everybody would agree. Maybe that person wouldn't even necessarily agree with you. And then that would that would be hard, right? Like if, especially in this age of like never Trumpers, right? Where people are like, I'm conservative, but I don't like Trump for these conservative reasons. You know, Republicans would be like, well, you're a Democrat and you're a liberal or whatever. Like Rick Wilson, he wrote a book called Everything Trump Touches Dies. And he was a Republican for a long time, but now he writes mostly for the Daily Beast. And he like really, really doesn't like Trump. And he shows up on MSNBC all the time to talk about that. You know, do people consider him a Republican, a conservative? So it's easier to look at the things he would like write and say, like on in an article, and then, you know, grade that as being left or right, because you can, you know, actually point to the words and not like what their internal beliefs are. That said, you know, knowing what a journalist has written in the past can be very indicative of like, you know, what they're likely to write in the future as well. So probably just won't make a chart of that. I wouldn't want to put their faces on there. Podcasts are kind of close though, because a lot of people like it's like the Me Show. You know, it's like their name and they're the podcast and it's what they're saying. So it's pretty tied close together.
Yeah. I guess I see one issue with maybe not wanting to address journalists in particular, which is kind of what we're seeing with this move where a lot of journalists are moving to platforms like mm-hmm. Substack or Medium. And obviously you can't just throw up a rating for Medium or Substack because mm-hmm. it's a platform where so many people can post. But if, mm-hmm. and this is a big if, but if more and more of the journalism moves to these kinds of platforms where they mm-hmm. there's not really a political leaning or brand itself, and the brand really is the individual journalist. Mm-hmm. I think at that point you might have to consider rating individual journalists.
Yeah, so we actually do rate a few Substack publications on the media bias chart just because they've become really popular, and you know they're you often identify not just by their names but by their, you know, the title of the. Of the publication. Like the Dispatch is mostly like Jonah Goldberg and David French, who used to write mostly for the National Review. But, you know, they like their views and views of other folks there seem to have like diverged over the Trump years. And so they have their own, the Dispatch. And we just rate that. We like rate the actual newsletter itself. So yeah, I know that often the journalists and the publication are one and the same, but so yeah, essentially we are rating, you know, we rate popular information, Jed Legume, right? So that's his Substack. And it's got a place on our media bias chart.
Okay. And for listeners of Creditor, they're obviously familiar with our platform. And Vanessa, you're familiar with what we do. Mm-hmm. We're doing something very similar, trying to get these trust ratings for news content on the article, author, and outlet level. Mm-hmm. And we take maybe a slightly different approach where we have a critic rating that is comprised of verified journalists, assuming they meet a couple basic requirements, and then mm-hmm. a public score that's accessible and open to any news consumer. I'm curious, do you ever see yourselves opening it up to news consumers in the future, kind of your rating mechanism, your process? Mm-hmm. Is there something that you maybe don't like about Creditor's approach of letting any individual participate in the ratings?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that we'll open it up to crowdsourcing or consumer input in the future. We just sort of want to make sure like our quality control for our process is, you know, robust and repeatable, and then so we can compare it to you know, crowdsource ratings, because, you know, what we found just over the past is that like as analysts get more experience, they get better, you know. And as analysts are like rate things with each other, then they get better, especially with people of opposite leans to them. And, you know, the reason we didn't go with crowdsourcing in the first place is sort of because of the, like the volume and like scope of stuff that we wanted to have rated ourselves. Right. So we wanted, you know, we knew we wanted these 100 sources, or, you know, to start out with, and like a continuous sample of these 100 sources, or like a consistent sample is what I mean. 15 articles here, 30 articles here, 45 articles here, you know, over 100. And so to get like that consistency, we just needed to like direct people, like, we want you to rate this one and you to rate this one. Because if we were like to, we found that like, you know, relying on folks to like do it on the free time, you know, it's sort of hard to rate news. And it's time consuming, right? And there are people who are very passionate about that. Like when we, the first time we recruited like volunteer analysts, you know, I sent an email blast to my list of like 1,000 people at the time, and like 150 people applied to be volunteer analysts, which I thought was amazing. But, you know, to do this like day in and day out and just kind of build up that volume, we found that like it was just easier for us to like have folks that we could train and now pay to, you know, just to do it consistently to build up that volume set. It doesn't mean that people can't do it, you know, if they're not trained, because, you know, people, they're like news savvy consumers, like people I'm sure like come to the Credit website that really do know what they're talking about. They've seen like a wide range of journalism out there, very savvy, very fully capable of making a rating or a critique. It was just more like the distribution that was important to us. And you know, the crowdsourcing of ratings that Credit is doing, and you know, the content analysis that Advantis is doing is different from opinion polling, right? Like we want it to be as far away from opinion polling, just saying like, well, what do you think? You know, do you trust this? Because yeah, I always go back to the example of like, there's lots of Pew Research polling on like media trust. And what does it always tell us? Well, it's low. Trust in media is low, kind of across the board, more some people than others. But those always include a question like, do you trust MSNBC? And if somebody says yes, then that means that they're just a Democrat. If somebody says no, it just means they're a Republican. So it doesn't tell you much about the ultimate, you know, credibility or bias of MSNBC. You know, the content tells you more of that. So that's just why, you know, like we take the approach that we do. It was more of like a structural thing, not that people like that the crowd can't do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it sounds like from just your little newsletter experiment there that people do seem willing to spend their time doing it. And I think that that all makes sense, especially around the distribution, because yeah, it's true. With Credit, we have no say. We can't be like, oh, here are the 60 top outlets that we need to make sure get rated. Mm-hmm. It's open. So we just have to hope that if those are the 60 outlets people are reading the most, maybe mm-hmm. they'll review them the most. So mm-hmm. I think that's a really good point. You guys have a lot more control on the outlets mm-hmm. that you end up getting rated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm wondering if there's ever pushback from news consumers who are looking at your ratings and they say, well, hold on, how come I don't get to be part of this rating? Is there any like level of a concern that keeps them from trusting your scores because they're not allowed to engage with them themselves?
No, I think we've avoided that criticism because we put out a lot of resources about our methodology you know, for public consumption over the years, and we keep trying to put out more. So you know, we have like explanations and white papers and stuff, but we also like, and this is like a member benefit, but we offer like our news literacy training courses that like any adult learner can take. So we do like a new 8-week course every 8 weeks or so, where it's live and they can have access to it. If they're a member, this is like one of our member benefits, like they can go in and like see our old videos and stuff and like do it on their own. But, you know, it's 8 hours of, you know, listening to me talk about our methodology and like train people on how to do it. So I think sometimes they look at that and they're like, okay, well, I guess it's a robust methodology.
And
we have teachers take it and people who want to be analysts take it, or, and, you know, retirees or just people who want to learn how to tell the difference between good news and bad news.
It's funny. Maybe you get a lot of this too, but a lot of the criticism that we get at Credit is just people saying the solution isn't this, it's more education, media literacy education mm-hmm. in high school and college. And we're mm-hmm. always like, yes, we agree. That
yes.
too. Like, dude, we support that. We're not against that. This is just what we're capable of having an impact on. We aren't capable of rewriting mm-hmm. the curriculum of all of the mm-hmm. world's schools. So is that a kind of a comment or an
yes.
easy pushback you get a lot?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually, what's crazy about that is like, we literally do provide media literacy education curriculum for schools, right?
Yeah.
And we have some schools that like have bought it. We have like, we are a large K-12 distributor called Mackin is now distributing our product in schools. But like not every school can like just magically incorporate media literacy. Like there's state standards. It takes time from teachers. They have to teach other things. They have to incorporate this into like whatever other like journalism or social studies or English that they're teaching, or librarians have to incorporate. Like this is, it's going to be a multi-year effort to really get media literacy in schools. But like, even though we offer it, we got some like pretty like mean criticism actually on a blog for librarians, for like academic and college librarians, saying that like, oh, the media bias chart. Well, here are all the reasons why it's terrible, right? And it was like, basically the main criticism was like, it's this shortcut, it's a meme, like it's not a meme, it's an infographic, right? But it's like a picture, and they're like, this is too simplistic, and it suggests that, you know, it replaces the field of information literacy. And it doesn't. Like, we really would love for people to just be able to discern the news themselves and like have all these skills and not have to rely on us as a third party. But look, not everybody has a time, not everybody has an inclination, not everybody has the ability to like become very media savvy and literate, right? Especially if they're not even in school anymore. So, you know, even though like that criticism is sort of always going to be there as a third party rating system, but I'm sure you hear it. We hear the exact same thing.
Yeah, very, very often on our end.
That's not the solution. And you're like, well, I'm doing something. Okay.
Yeah. What are you doing? Yeah.
Exactly. Complaining.
Exactly.
I hear you.
one other aspect of that is that even if we had the most perfect media literacy education curriculum in all around the world, that wouldn't technically resolve some of the issues we have with online media and the advertising and the incentives mm-hmm. to
right.
put out false or misleading or clickbaity sensational content. So it's like, mm-hmm. even if we were all armed perfectly with the intellect and the media mm-hmm. literacy training to do so, there's still some broken incentives that mm-hmm. underlie the media today online. And mm-hmm. we have to address that separately. So
right. Yeah, like when it goes exactly back to that, like people saying, well, this isn't the solution. This is. Well, all of the solutions have to be addressed.
Yeah.
You agree. Like you're not disputing this. You're not saying like no media literacy education is not the solution. Like you've never said that.
It's almost like before Kreder makes a tweet, we need to like disclaimer. Yes, we believe media literacy education is important. Yeah. Okay, so I have two questions that I ask every guest that comes on the podcast, but before we get there, and before we get to you kind of giving listeners some links that they can go to follow your work, what is it that you guys are working on next? Do you have something that's coming around the corner, something that's baking?
Yeah, well, we have a lot of, we've been rating a lot of podcasts. We'll be rating more. And we have been rating a lot of TV and video network cable online shows, and we get lots of requests for that. We've gotten requests for that over the years. People ask about like, what about the Young Turks, or what about like PragerU, or you know, like OAN and Newsmax shows, or RT or Cheddar. Or, like, there's all these online shows. People get a lot of stuff from YouTube, and it's just logistically harder to rate those because they're longer, and you know, we've got like software in the back end for like you're collecting these ratings from analysts, and there's like scheduling that has to happen. So, you know, it's been a big lift for us to get these all rated, but we'll be coming out with some new TV and video ratings that I think people will be excited about. And, you know, we're just always looking to grow our data set, because, you know, the more we have, the more useful it can be to everyone. So yeah, that's the main thing we've got cooking, and I think we got a lot cooking, but that's a big one.
Okay, great. And why don't you give listeners a few links, maybe your website URL, wherever you'd like mm-hmm. to send them, maybe a personal Twitter handle as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just go to adfontesmedia.com. That's ADFONTES media, MEDIA Crediter.com. You'll find the media bias chart there, like the static version. Go to our interactive version, which is really cool. And you can search all the different sources that we have. And you'll see all the different resources we have for learning about what you can do to improve the media ecosystem yourself. And my Twitter is at AdFontes Media. And me personally, I'm at VLOTERO, O-T-V-L-O-T-E-R-O. So I'm happy to see you there, and I'll respond sometimes.
That's true. She will. Okay. And all of those will be linked in the show notes. So go ahead and check those out. Last two questions for you here that I ask every guest that comes on the podcast. They're going to be a little out of left field, but sure. Like to get people's takes on them. The yeah. first is Bitcoin. Believer, not a believer, not at all educated enough to say one way or the other. Where are you at on Bitcoin?
Well, I know it's a blockchain currency. Like, I'm a patent lawyer, so I sort of kind of had to learn what blockchain was. And, you know, it's not my thing, but it doesn't mean that there's not like value in it for lots of people. Like this, I know there's lots of value and opportunity in it, but it's sort of like the stock market or real estate, or like NFTs now, which is like the other blockchain thing. It's a really interesting and appealing money game to people who understand it, and not everybody understands it, and not everybody is into it, just like they're not all into, you know, short selling stocks or like investing in real estate, right? So if it's your thing, great. There is lots of opportunity in there. But I find that like things that require explanation to smart people like 5 or 6 times before they get it are really kind of hard to catch on for the masses, you know? Like, well, yeah. It's a distributed ledger. Like, okay, what does that even mean? Most people say.
My simplest explanation when I do give it is it's a superior, and again, not financial advice, but if I was to explain what Bitcoin is, I would say it is a superior savings technology because it relies on a fixed supply digital asset that basically protects your purchasing power over time from debasement or inflation or government printing, something like that. That I think is like the easiest explanation, but still then the question comes up, what is money? And you lose 99% of people right there.
Yeah. I mean, that's a, you know, simple explanation, but for a smart guy, you know, so I think you still lose some people. So, yeah. But yeah, it's, you know, some like very, you know, complex things. There's just a lot of opportunity in them.
Yeah. All right. And last question for you here is, are we living in a simulation?
No.
No. Hard no. Hard pass on simulation theory.
No. Yeah. look, in our work, we get real philosophical about like, what is true? You know, that's a question that people ask us all the time. They're like, how do you know it's true in the news? And if you get down to it, the real answer is like, you can't know if anything is true. But then if that's the answer, then how do you operate in the world? How do you make decisions that are like better or worse in the time that you are living? You have to be able to say, all right, some things are more true than others, and make good decisions based on that. There's a great book called Thinking and Bets by Annie Duke. And it's about making good decisions when you don't have all the information. And that's what we're doing when we're trying to evaluate the veracity of the news. So yeah, we can say like, what is true and what is real? There's sort of infinite regress and say like, oh, how do I even know that I'm real? And then
you don't,
right? And so I'm comfortable drawing lines and saying, you know, even though I'm a lawyer and I can always say it, the answer depends, I will give you an answer. And here the answer is no, we're not living in a simulation.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Vanessa Otero, thank you so much for joining me today on the Crediter podcast. It was really great to, you know, talk about this shared space and founder to founder and all the concerns and criticisms that we hear all the time. Really great to know there's somebody else out there fielding that same kind of feedback. And if there's ever an opportunity for our organizations to collaborate in some way, just know that Creditor is an open door. And thank you for coming on. We might want to have you back on again when you put out your newest or next updated version of the media bias chart. And everybody, please go and follow your work.
Awesome. Thanks so much. It was great being here. I appreciate what you do.
Thanks, Vanessa. Bye.
Take care.